Leviathan, Part 2, Commonwealth, by Thomas Hobbes. First published in 1651. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 17 through 19. Chapter 17, The Causes, Creation, and Definition of a Commonwealth. Men naturally love liberty and dominion over others. So what is the final cause or end or design they have in mind when they introduce the restraint upon themselves under which we see them live in commonwealths? It is the prospect of their own preservation, and, through that, of a more contented life, that is, of getting themselves out of the miserable condition of war, which, as I have shown, necessarily flows from the natural passions of men, when there is no visible power to keep them in awe, and tie them by fear of punishment to keep their covenants, and to obey the laws of nature, set down in my chapters 14 and 15. For the laws of nature, enjoining justice, fairness, modesty, mercy, and, in short, treating others as we want them to treat us, are in themselves contrary to our natural passions, unless some power frightens us into observing them. In the absence of such a power, our natural passions carry us to partiality, pride, revenge, and the like. And covenants without the sword are merely words, with no strength to secure a man at all. Every man has obeyed the laws of nature when he has wanted to, which is when he could do it safely. But if there is no power set up, or none that is strong enough for our security, no one can safely abide by the laws. And in that case every man will, and lawfully may, rely on his own strength and skill to protect himself against all other men. In all places where men have lived in small families, with no larger organized groupings, the trade of robber was so far from being regarded as against the law of nature, that it was outright honored, so that the greater the spoils someone gained by robbery, the greater was his honor. The only constraints on robbery came from the laws of honour, which enjoined robbers to abstain from cruelty, and to let their victims keep their lives and their farm implements. These days, cities and kingdoms, which are only greater families, do what small families used to do back then. For their own security, they enlarge their dominions on the basis of claims that they are in danger and in fear of invasion, or that assistance might be given to invaders by the country they are attacking. They do their best to subdue or weaken their neighbours, by open force and secret manoeuvres, and if they have no other means for their own security, they do this justly, and are honoured for it in later years. They cannot get this security that everyone seeks by banding together in small groups, because when the numbers are small, a small addition on the one side or the other makes the advantage of strength so great that it suffices to carry the victory, and so it gives encouragement for an invasion. How many must we be to be secure? That depends not on any particular number, but on comparison with the enemy we fear. We have enough, if the enemy doesn't outnumber us by so much that that would settle the outcome of a war between us, which would encourage the enemy to start one. And however many of them there are, if the actions of each are directed by his wants and beliefs, they can't expect their actions to defend or protect them against a common enemy, or against injuries from one another. For being drawn in different directions by their differing opinions concerning how best to use their strength, they hinder rather than help one another, and by quarrelling among themselves they reduce their strength to nothing. When that happens, they are easily subdued by a very small unified group of men, and when there's no common enemy, they make war on each other for their particular interests. For if we could suppose a great multitude of men all observing justice and other laws of nature without a common power to keep them all in awe, we might as well suppose all mankind to do the same, and then there would not be, and would not need to be, any civil government or commonwealth at all, because there would be peace without subjection. For the security that men desire to last throughout their lifetimes, it's not enough that they be governed and directed by one judgment for a limited time, as for one battle or one war. For in that case, even if they obtain a victory through their unanimous efforts against a foreign enemy, yet afterwards the difference of their interests makes it certain that they will fall apart, and once more come to be at war amongst themselves. It's true that certain living creatures, such as bees and ants, live sociably with one another, which is why Aristotle counts them among the political creatures, from the Greek politike, meaning social. Although each of them is steered only by its particular judgments and appetites, and they don't have speech, through which one might indicate to another what it thinks expedient for the common benefit. You may want to know why mankind can't do the same. My answer to that has six parts. Firstly, men continually compete with one another for honour and dignity, which ants and bees do not. And that leads men, unlike those other animals, to envy and hatred, and finally war. Secondly, among those lower creatures, the common good of all is the same as the private good of each, and being naturally inclined to its private benefit in procuring that, they also procure the common benefit. But a man's biggest pleasure in his own advantages comes from their being greater than those of others. Thirdly, bees and ants and their like don't have the use of reason, as man does, and so they don't see, and don't think they see, any fault in how their common business is organized, whereas very many men think themselves wiser than the rest, and better equipped to govern the public. These men struggle to reform and innovate, one in this way and another in that, thereby bringing the Commonwealth into distraction and civil war. Fourthly, these creatures, though they have some use of voice in making known their desires and other affections, don't have that skill with words through which some men represent good things to others, in the guise of evil, and evil in the guise of good, and misrepresent how great various goods and evils are. These activities enable their practitioners, whenever they feel like it, to make men discontented and to disturb their peace. Fifthly, creatures that lack reason don't have the notion of being insulted or wronged, as distinct from being physically damaged. So as long as they are at ease physically, they are not offended with their fellows. Whereas man is most troublesome when he is most at ease, for that is when he loves to show his wisdom and to control the actions of those who govern the Commonwealth. Sixthly, and lastly, the agreement of these creatures is natural, whereas men's agreement is by covenant only, which is artificial. So it's no wonder if something besides the covenant is needed to make their agreement constant and lasting, namely, a common power to keep them in awe and direct their actions to the common benefit. The only way to establish a common power that can defend men from the invasion of foreigners and the injuries of one another, and thereby make them secure enough to be able to nourish themselves and live contentedly through their own labours and the fruits of the earth, is to confer all their power and strength on one man, or one assembly of men, so as to turn all their wills by a majority vote into a single will. That is to say, to appoint one man or assembly of men to bear their person, and everyone to acknowledge himself to be the author of every act that this man or assembly performs or causes to be performed, relating to the common peace and safety, and all of them to submit their wills to the will, and their judgments to the judgment of this man or assembly. This is more than mere agreement or harmony. It is a real unity of them all. They are unified in that they constitute one single person, created through a covenant of every man with every other man, as though each man were to say to each of the others, "I authorize and give up my right of governing myself to this man, or to this assembly of men, on condition that you surrender to him your right of governing yourself, and authorize all his actions in the same way." When this is done, the multitude so united in one person is called a commonwealth, in Latin civitas. This is the method of creation of that great Leviathan, or rather, to speak more reverently, of that mortal God to which we owe, under the immortal God, our peace and defence. For by this authority that has been given to this man by every individual man in the Commonwealth, this man acquires so much power and strength that people's fear of it enables him to harmonize and control the wills of them all, to the end of peace at home and mutual aid against their enemies abroad. He is the essence of the Commonwealth, which can be defined thus. A Commonwealth is one person of whose acts a great multitude of people have made themselves the authors, each of them an author, doing this by mutual covenants with one another, so that the Commonwealth may use the strength and means of them all, as he shall think appropriate, for their peace and common defence. He who has the role of this person is called sovereign, and is said to have sovereign power, and all the others are his subjects. Sovereign power can be attained in two ways. One is by natural force, as when a man makes his children submit themselves and their children to his government, by being able to destroy them if they refuse, or subdues his enemies to his will by war, sparing their lives on condition that they submit their wills to his government. The other is when men agree amongst themselves to submit to some one man or assembly of men, doing this voluntarily in the confidence that this man or assembly will protect them against all others. This latter may be called a political commonwealth, or commonwealth by institution, and the former a commonwealth by acquisition. I shall speak first of a commonwealth by institution, turning to commonwealth by acquisition in chapter 20. Chapter 18. The Rights of Sovereigns by Institution. A commonwealth is said to be instituted when a multitude of men agree and covenant, each one with each other, that when some man or assembly of men is chosen by majority vote to present the person of them all, that is, to be their representative, each will authorize all the actions and judgments of that man or assembly of men as though they were his own, doing this for the purpose of living peacefully among themselves and being protected against other men. This binds those who did not vote for this representative, as well as those who did. For unless the votes are all understood to be included in the majority of votes, they have come together in vain. And contrary to the end that each proposed for himself, namely the peace and protection of them all. From the form of the institution are derived all the power and all the rights of the one having supreme power, as well as the duties of all the citizens. I shall discuss these rights, powers, and duties under 12 headings. First, because the people make a covenant, it is to be understood that they aren't obliged by any previous covenant to do anything conflicting with this new one. Consequently, those who have already instituted a commonwealth, being thereby bound by a covenant to own the actions and judgments of one sovereign, cannot lawfully get together to make a new covenant, to be obedient to someone else, in any respect at all, without their sovereign's permission. So those who are subject to a monarch can't, without his permission, throw off monarchy and return to the confusion of a disunited multitude, or transfer their person from him who now bears it to some other man or other assembly of men. For they are bound, each of them to each of the others, to own and be the proclaimed author of everything that their existing sovereign does and judges fit to be done. And they have also, every man of them, given the sovereignty to him who bears their person. So if they depose him, they take from him something that is his, and that is injustice. Furthermore, if anyone who tries to depose his sovereign is killed or punished for this by the sovereign, he is an author of his own punishment, because the covenant makes him an author of everything his sovereign does. And since it is injustice for a man to do anything with which he may be punished by his own authority, his attempt to depose his sovereign is unjust for that reason also. Some men have claimed to base their disobedience to their sovereign on a new covenant that they have made, not with men, but with God. And this also is unjust, for there's no covenant with God, except through the mediation of someone who represents God's person, and the only one who does that is God's lieutenant, who has the sovereignty under God. But this claim of a covenant with God is so obviously a lie, even in the claimant's own conscience, that it is the act of a disposition that is not only unjust, but also vile and unmanly. Second, what gives the sovereign a right to bear the person of all his subjects, is a covenant that they make with one another, and not a covenant between him and any of them. There can't be a breach of covenant on his part, and, consequently, none of his subjects can be freed from subjection by a claim that the sovereign has forfeited his right to govern by breaking his covenant with his subjects. It is obvious that the sovereign makes no covenant with his subjects on the way to becoming sovereign. To see why this is true, suppose that it isn't, and for ease of exposition, suppose that you are one of the subjects. In that case, the sovereign must either make a covenant with the whole multitude as the other party, or make a separate covenant with each man, including one with you. But it can't be with the whole as one party, because at this point they are not one person. And if he makes as many separate covenants as there are men, those covenants become void after he becomes sovereign. Why? Because any act of the sovereign's that you, for example, can claim to be a breach of your covenant with him, is an act of yours and of everyone else's, because it was done by the sovereign, and thus was done in the person, and by the right, of every individual subject including you. Besides, if one or more of the subjects claims a breach of the covenant made by the sovereign, in his becoming sovereign, and one or more other subjects contend that there was no such breach, or, indeed, if only the sovereign himself contends this, there's no judge to decide the controversy. So it returns to the sword again, and every man regains the right of protecting himself by his own strength, contrary to the design they had in the institution of the Commonwealth. The opinion that any monarch receives his power by covenant, that is, on some condition, comes from a failure to grasp this easy truth. Because covenants are merely words and breath, they have no force to oblige, contain, constrain, or protect any man, except whatever force comes from the public sword, that is, from the hands of the man or assembly that has the sovereignty. Nobody imagines that a covenant was at work when an assembly of men was made sovereign in the first place. For no man is so stupid as to say, for example, that the people of Rome made a covenant with the Romans to hold the sovereignty on such and such conditions, the non-performance of which would entitle the Romans to depose the Roman people. Why don't men see that the basic principles of a monarchy are the same as those of a popular government? They are led away from seeing this by the ambition of people who prefer government by an assembly to government by a monarchy, because they can hope to participate in the former, but despair of enjoying the latter. Third, because the majority have by consenting voices declared a sovereign, someone who dissented must now go along with the others, that is, be contented to accept all the actions the sovereign performs, and if he doesn't, he may justly be destroyed by the others. For if he voluntarily joined a group who came together to consider instituting a sovereign, he thereby sufficiently declared his willingness to accept what the majority should decide on, and therefore tacitly covenanted to do so. So if he then refuses to accept it, or protests against any of their decrees, he is acting contrary to his tacit covenant, and therefore unjustly. Furthermore, whether or not he enters into the congregation, and whether or not his consent is asked, he must either submit to the majority's decrees, or be left in the condition of war he was in previously, in which he can, without injustice, be destroyed by any man at all. Fourth, because every subject is by this institution of the Commonwealth the author of all the actions and judgments of the sovereign, it follows that nothing the sovereign does can injure any of his subjects, nor ought any of them to accuse him of injustice. For no one, acting by the authority of someone else, can do injury to the person by whose authority he acts. But according to this institution of a commonwealth, every individual man is an author of everything the sovereign does. So someone who complains of injury from his sovereign complains about something of which he himself is an author, so he oughtn't to accuse anyone but himself. And indeed, he oughtn't even to accuse himself of injuring himself, because it is impossible to do injury to oneself. It's true that those who have sovereign power may commit iniquity, that is, do wicked things, but not injustice or injury in the proper meaning of that term. Fifth, following from the preceding point, no man who has sovereign power can justly be put to death, or punished in any other way by his subjects. For seeing that every subject is an author of the actions of his sovereign, if he punishes the sovereign, he punishes someone else for actions committed by himself. And because the goal of this institution is the peace and defence of them all, and whoever has a right to the goal has a right to the means to it, the man or assembly that has the sovereignty has the right to be judge both of the means to peace and defence, and also of the hindrances and disturbances of peace and defence, and to do whatever he thinks is needed, both beforehand, for preserving peace and security, by prevention of discord at home and hostility from abroad, and for the recovery of peace and security after they have been lost. And therefore, sixth, it is for the sovereignty, that is, the man or assembly of men to whom the sovereignty has been given, to be the judge of what opinions and doctrines are threats to peace, and what ones tend to support it, and consequently of which men are to be trusted to speak to multitudes of people, on what occasions, and how far they should be allowed to go, and of who shall examine the doctrines of all books before they are published. For the actions of men come from their opinions, and the way to govern men's actions in the interests of peace and harmony is to govern their opinions. When we are considering doctrines, nothing ought to be taken account of but truth. But this doesn't conflict with regulating doctrines on grounds related to peace. For a doctrine that is harmful to peace can't be true, any more than peace and harmony can be against the law of nature. It's true that in a commonwealth, where the negligence or incompetence of governors and teachers has allowed false doctrines to become generally believed, the contrary truths may be generally found to be offensive. But even the most sudden and rough bustling in of a new truth never breaks the peace, but only sometimes awakens the war. I said awakens the war, not starts it. For men who are so slackly governed that they dare take up arms to defend or introduce an opinion are at war already. Their state is not peace, but only a cessation of arms through mutual fear, and they live continually on the fringe of a battlefield, so to speak. So he who has the sovereign power must be the judge, or establish others as judges, of opinions and doctrines, this being necessary for peace and the avoidance of discord and civil war. Seventh, the sovereignty has the whole power of prescribing the rules that let every man know what goods he may enjoy, and what actions he may perform, without being troubled by any of his fellow subjects. And this is what men call property. Before the establishment of sovereign power, as I have already shown, all men had a right to all things, a state of affairs which necessarily causes war. And therefore this system of property, being necessary for peace and dependent on sovereign power, is one of the things done by sovereign power in the interests of public peace. These rules of property, or mine and yours, are the civil laws, that is, the laws of each individual commonwealth. Eighth, the sovereignty alone has the right of judging, that is to say, of hearing and deciding any controversies that may arise concerning law, civil or natural, or concerning fact. For if controversies are not decided, one subject has no protection against being wronged by another. The laws concerning mine and yours have no effect, and every man retains, because of the natural and inevitable desire for his own preservation, the right to protect himself by his own private strength, which is the condition of war, and is contrary to the purpose for which every commonwealth is instituted. Ninth, the sovereignty alone has the right to make war and peace with other nations and commonwealths, that is, the right to judge when war is for the public good, to decide what size of military forces are to be assembled, and to tax the subjects to cover the costs of arming and paying those forces. For the power by which the people are to be defended consists in their armies, and the strength of an army consists in the union of the soldiers' strengths under one command. And it's the instituted sovereign who has that command. Indeed, having command of the military is enough to make someone sovereign, without his being instituted as such in any other way. So whoever is appointed as general of an army, it's always the sovereign power who is its supreme commander. 10th. It is for the sovereignty to choose all counsellors, ministers, magistrates, and officers in both peace and war. For seeing that the sovereign is charged with achieving the goal of the common peace and defence, he is understood to have the power to use whatever means he thinks most fit for this purpose. 11th. To the sovereign is entrusted the power of rewarding with riches or honour, and of punishing with corporal punishment or fines or public disgrace, every subject according to the law already made by the sovereign, or, if no relevant law has been made, according to the sovereign's judgment about what rewards and punishments are most likely to be effective. 12th and last, there must be laws of honour, and a public rate or price list stating the values of men who have deserved well of the Commonwealth, or may yet do so, and to give someone the power to put those laws into effect. This is necessary because of how highly men are apt to value themselves, how much respect they want, and how little they give, all of which continually gives rise to resentful envy, quarrels, side-taking, and eventually war. I said that someone must control these honours. For reasons I have already given, this someone must be the sovereign. So it's the sovereign whose role it is to give titles of honour, and to appoint what order of place and dignity each man shall hold, and what signs of respect they shall give to one another in public or private meetings. These are the rights that make the essence of sovereignty, and are the marks by which one can tell what man or assembly of men has the sovereign power. For these rights and powers can't be shared, and can't be separated from one another. The sovereign may transfer to someone else the power to coin money, to dispose of the estate and persons of infant heirs, to have certain advantages in markets, or any other prerogative that is governed by particular laws, while still retaining the power to protect his subjects. But if he transfers the military, it's no use his retaining the power of judging, because he will have no way of enforcing the laws. Or if he gives away the power of raising money, the military is useless. Or if he gives away the control of doctrines, men will be frightened into rebellion by religious fears. So if we consider any one of the rights I have discussed, we shall immediately see that it is essential, because the holding of all the others without that one will have no effect on the conservation of peace and justice, the purpose for which all commonwealths are instituted. If a majority of people in England hadn't come to think that these powers were shared among the King, the Lords, and the House of Commons, the people would never have been divided and fallen into this civil war, first over disagreements in politics, and then over disagreements about freedom of religion. A war that has so instructed men in this matter of sovereign rights that most people in England do now see that these rights are inseparable. This will be generally acknowledged when peace next returns, and it will continue to be acknowledged for as long as people remember their miseries in the war, though it won't continue beyond that unless the common people come to be better taught than they have been until now. And because these rights are essential and inseparable, it follows that the sovereign can't give any of them to someone else, unless he at the same time explicitly renounces the sovereign power, and is not given the title sovereign from then onwards. This great authority being indivisible, and inseparably assigned to the sovereignty, there is little basis for the opinion of those who say of sovereign kings that though they have greater power than every one of their subjects, they have less power than all their subjects together. What has to be meant by all their subjects together is the collective body as one person, and the power of this person is the same as the sovereign's power, so that what they say is absurd. They could see its absurdity well enough when the sovereign is an assembly of all the people, but they don't see it when the sovereign is a monarch. Yet the power of sovereignty is the same, whoever has it. just as the power of the sovereign ought to be greater than that of any or all of the subjects, so should the sovereign's honour. For the sovereignty is the fountain of honour. The dignities of lord, earl, duke, and prince are created by him, just as servants in the presence of their master are equal, and without any honour at all, so are subjects in the presence of their sovereign. When they are out of his sight, some may shine more than others, but in his presence they shine no more than do the stars in the presence of the sun. But someone may object here that subjects are in a miserable situation, because they are at the mercy of the lusts and other irregular passions of him who has, or of those who have, such unlimited power. Commonly those who live under a monarch think their troubles are the fault of monarchy, and those who live under the government of democracy, or some other kind of sovereign assembly, attribute all the inconvenience to that form of commonwealth, when really the sovereign power is the same in every form of commonwealth, as long as it is complete enough to protect the subjects. These complainers don't bear in mind that the human condition can never be without some inconvenience or other, or that the greatest trouble that can possibly come to the populace in any form of government is almost nothing when compared with the miseries and horrible calamities that accompany a civil war, or with the dissolute condition of ungoverned men who are not subject to laws and a coercive power to dissuade them back from robbery and revenge. Nor do they bear in mind that the greatest burdens laid on subjects by sovereign governors do not come from any pleasure or profit the governors can expect from weakening their subjects, whose vigour constitutes their own strength and glory, but from the subjects' own stubborn unwillingness to contribute to their own defence, which makes it necessary for their governors to get what they can from them in taxes in time of peace, so as to have the means to resist their enemies, or to get an advantage over them if an occasion for this should suddenly present itself. For all men are provided by nature with notable microscopes, that is, their passions and self-love, through which every little payment appears as a great grievance, but don't have the telescopes, namely moral and political science, that would enable them to see far off the miseries that hang over them, which can't be avoided without such payments. Chapter 19. Kinds of Commonwealth by Institution, and Succession to the Sovereign Power. Differences amongst commonwealths come from differences in the sovereign or the person who represents every one of the multitude. The sovereignty resides either in one man or in an assembly of more than one. And when it is an assembly, either every man has a right to enter the assembly, or only certain men distinguished from the rest. So clearly, there can be only three kinds of commonwealth, for the representative must be one man or more than one, and if more than one, then it's either the assembly of all the multitude or an assembly containing only some of them. When the representative is one man, the commonwealth is a monarchy. When it's an assembly of only some of the multitude, then it is called an aristocracy. When it's an assembly of all that are willing to come together, it is a democracy or popular commonwealth. There can't be any other kind of commonwealth, because the sovereign power, which I have shown to be indivisible, must be possessed by one, by more than one, but less than all, or by all. Books of history and political theory contain other names for governments, such as tyranny and oligarchy, but they are not the names of other forms of government. They are names of the same forms, given by people who dislike them. Those who are discontented under monarchy call it tyranny, and those who are displeased with aristocracy call it oligarchy. So also those who find themselves aggrieved under a democracy call it anarchy, which means lack of any government. But I don't think anyone believes that lack of government is any new kind of government. Nor, to continue the line of thought, ought they to believe that the government is of one kind when they like it, and of another when they dislike it, or are oppressed by the governors. Obviously men who are in absolute liberty may, if they please, give authority to one man to represent them all, or give such authority to any assembly of men whatever, so they are free to subject themselves to a monarch as absolutely as to any other representative, if they think fit to do so. Therefore, where a sovereign power has already been established, there can be no other representative of the same people, except for certain particular purposes whose limits are set by the sovereign. If there were two unrestricted representatives, that would be to establish two sovereigns, and every man would have his person represented by two actors. If these opposed one another, this would divide the power that must be indivisible, if men are to live in peace, and would thereby pull the multitude down into the condition of war. So it would be absurd for a monarch, having invited the people of his dominion to send him their deputies with power to give him advice or tell him their desires, to think that these deputies, rather than himself, were the absolute representative of the people. The absurdity is even more obvious if this idea is applied not to a monarch, but to a sovereign assembly. I don't know how this obvious truth came to be so disregarded in England in recent years. In this country we had a monarchy, in which he who had the sovereignty, in a line of descent 600 years long, was alone called sovereign, had the title Majesty from every one of his subjects, and was unquestionably accepted by them as their king. Yet he was never considered as their representative, that name being given, with no sense that this was a contradiction, to the men who, at his command, were sent to him by the people to bring their petitions and advice. This may serve as a warning for those who are the true and absolute representatives of a people, that if they want to fulfil the trust that has been committed to them, they had better instruct men in the nature of the office of sovereign, and be careful how they permit any other general representation on any occasion whatsoever. The differences among these three kinds of commonwealth don't consist in differences in the amount of power, but in differences in how serviceable they are, how apt to produce the peace and security of the people, the purpose for which they were instituted. I now want to compare monarchy with the other two, making 6 points about this comparison. First, anyone who bears the person of the people, or belongs to the assembly that bears it, also bears his own natural person, that is, bears himself considered just as one human being. And though he is careful in his official person to procure the common interest, he is at least as careful to procure the private good of himself, his family, relatives, and friends. And when the public interest happens to conflict with the private, he usually prefers the private, because men's passions are commonly more powerful than their reason. It follows from this that the public interest is most advanced when it coincides with the private interest of the sovereign. Now in monarchy, the private interest is the same as the public. The riches, power, and honour of a monarch arise purely from the riches, strength, and reputation of his subjects. For no king can be rich or glorious or secure if his subjects are poor or wretched, or so much weakened by poverty or dissension that they can't maintain a war against their enemies. In a democracy or an aristocracy, on the other hand, public prosperity often does less for the private fortune of a corrupt or ambitious subject than does lying advice, treacherous action, or civil war. Second, a monarch decides who will advise him, and when and where, so he can hear the opinions of men who are knowledgeable about the matter in question, men of any rank or status, and as long in advance of the action and with as much secrecy as he likes. But when a sovereign assembly needs advice, it can't have advisers from outside its own body. And of those who are in the assembly, few are skilled in civic matters, the majority of them being orators who give their opinions in speeches full of pretense or of inept learning, and either disrupt the commonwealth or do it no good. For the flame of the passions dazzles the understanding, but never enlightens it. And there's no place or time at which an assembly can receive advice in secret. There are too many of them for that. Third, the resolutions of a monarch are not subject to any inconstancy, except that of human nature. But in assemblies, besides the inconstancy of nature, there is an inconstancy of numbers. Something that the assembly decided yesterday may be undone today, because a few members who wanted it reversed showed up, while those who would have wanted yesterday's resolution to hold firm have stayed away because they were too confident or negligent or for personal reasons. Fourth, a monarch can't disagree with himself out of envy or self-interest, but an assembly can, and the disagreement may be so strenuous as to lead to a civil war. Fifth, in monarchy there's this disadvantage. Any subject may be deprived of all he possesses by the power of one man, the sovereign, so as to enrich a favourite or flatterer, though history does not tell us that this has ever been done. I admit that this is a great and inevitable disadvantage. But the same thing can just as well happen where the sovereign power is in an assembly, for their power is the same, and they are as likely to be seduced into accepting bad advice from orators as a monarch is from flatterers, and they can become one another's flatterers, taking turns in serving one another's greed and ambition. Also, a monarch has only a few favourites, and the only others they may want to advance are their own relatives, whereas the favourites of an assembly are many, and the relatives of the members of an assembly are much more numerous than those of any monarch. Besides, any favourite of a monarch can help his friends as well as hurt his enemies, but orators, i.e. favourites of sovereign assemblies, have great power to hurt, but little to help. For accusing requires less eloquence than does excusing. Also, condemning looks more like justice than pardoning does. Sixth, in a monarchy, the sovereignty may descend to an infant, or to one who can't tell good from bad, which has the alleged drawback that then the use of the sovereign's power must be in the hands of another man, or of some assembly of men, who are to govern by the child's right and in his name, as guardians and protectors of his person and his authority. But to say there is a drawback in putting the use of the sovereign power into the hands of a man or an assembly of men is to say that all government is less satisfactory than confusion and civil war, which is absurd. So the only danger that can be claimed to arise from a situation where the monarchy has been inherited by someone not yet fit to exercise its powers has to do with the struggles among those who become competitors for an office bringing so much honour and profit. This disadvantage does not come from the form of government we call monarchy. To see this, consider the case where the previous monarch has appointed those who are to have the care of his infant successor, doing this either by an explicit statement or implicitly by not interfering with the customarily accepted procedure for such appointments. In that case, if the competition disadvantage arises, it should be attributed not to the monarchy but to the ambition and injustice of the subjects, and those vices are the same in all kinds of government where the people are not well instructed in their duty and in the rights of sovereignty. For the case where the previous monarch has made no provision at all for such care of his infant successor, the law of nature has provided this sufficient rule, that the infant sovereign shall be cared for by the man who has by nature the most to gain from the preservation of the infant's authority, and the least to gain from the child's dying or losing authority. For since every man by nature seeks his own benefit and promotion, to put an infant under the control of people who can promote themselves by destroying or harming him is not guardianship, but treachery. So once sufficient provision has been made against any proper dispute about the government under a child, if any contest does start up and disturb the public peace, it should be attributed not to the form of monarchy, but to the subject's ambition and ignorance of their duty. On the other side, every great commonwealth whose sovereignty is in a great assembly is, in matters of peace and war and the making of laws, in the same condition as if the power of government were theoretically in a child. For just as a child lacks the judgment to disagree with advice that is given him, and so has to accept the advice of whoever has the care of him, so also an assembly lacks the freedom to disagree with the advice of the majority, whether it's good or bad. And just as a child needs a guardian or protector to preserve his person and his authority, so also in great commonwealths the sovereign assembly, in all times of great danger and trouble, needs guardians of liberty. That is, they need dictators or protectors of their authority, who amount to being temporary monarchs, to whom they can for a time commit the exercise of all their power. And it has more often happened and at the end of that time the assembly were permanently deprived of their power by that dictator, than it has happened that infant kings were deprived of their power by their protectors, regents, or any other guardians. I have shown that there are only three kinds of sovereignty: monarchy, where one man has the sovereignty; democracy, where the general assembly of all the subjects has it; and aristocracy, where it is in an assembly of certain persons picked out in some way from the rest. Still, someone who surveys the particular commonwealths that did or do exist in the world may find it hard to classify them in terms of this trio, which may incline him to think there are other forms arising from mixtures of these three. For example, elective kingdoms, where kings have the sovereign power put into their hands for a time, or kingdoms where the king has limited power, though most writers call these governments monarchies, or if a democratic or aristocratic commonwealth subdues an enemy's country and governs it through an appointed governor, executive officer, or other legal authority, this may perhaps seem at first sight to be a democratic or aristocratic government. But this is all wrong, for elective kings are not sovereigns, but ministers of the sovereign. Limited kings are not sovereigns, but ministers of those who have the sovereign power. And provinces that are in subjection to a democracy or aristocracy of another commonwealth are themselves governed not democratically or aristocratically, but monarchically. I shall discuss these three cases at more length. Concerning an elective king, whose power is limited to his life, as it is in many parts of Christendom at this day, or to certain years or months, like the dictator's power among the Romans, if he has the right to appoint his successor, he is no longer an elective king, but an hereditary one. But if he has no power to designate his successor, then either some other known man or assembly can designate a successor after his death, or the commonwealth dies and dissolves with him, and returns to the condition of war. If it's known which people have the power to award the sovereignty after his death, it's also known that the sovereignty was in them while he was alive. For nobody has the right to give something that he doesn't have the right to possess, and to keep to himself if he sees fit. But if there's no one who can give the sovereignty after the death of the one who was first elected, then that king has the power to establish his own successor, so as to keep those who had trusted him with the government from relapsing into the miserable condition of civil war. Indeed, he is obliged by the law of nature to take care of this. So he was, as soon as he was elected, an absolute sovereign. The king whose power is limited is not superior to whoever has the power to limit it, and he who is not superior to someone is not supreme, which is to say that he is not sovereign. So the sovereignty always was in the assembly that had the right to limit him, which implies that the government is not monarchy, but either democracy or aristocracy. As in ancient Sparta, where the kings had the privilege of leading their armies, but the sovereignty was possessed by magistrates with authority over the king's conduct. Thirdly, although the Roman people governed the land of Judea, for example, through a governor, this didn't make Judea a democracy, because they weren't governed by any assembly into which each of them had a right to enter. Nor was it an aristocracy, because they weren't governed by any assembly that a man could be selected to belong to. Rather, it was a monarchy. They were governed by one person. In relation to the people of Rome, this one person was an assembly of all the people, that is, a democracy. But in relation to the people of Judea, who had no right to participate in the government, it was a monarchy, where the people are governed by an assembly chosen by themselves out of their own number. The government is called a democracy or an aristocracy, but when they are governed by an assembly that they didn't choose, it is a monarchy, not of one man over another man, but of one people over another people. The matter of all these forms of government consists in monarchs and assemblies. These die, so the matter is mortal. So it is necessary for the preservation of peace that steps be taken not only for the creation of an artificial man, but also for that man to have an artificial eternity of life. Without that, men governed by an assembly would return into the condition of war in every generation, and men governed by one man would return to it as soon as their governor dies. This artificial eternity is what men call the right of succession. In any perfect form of government, the present sovereign has the right to decide how the succession will go. For if the right were possessed by any other particular man or non-sovereign assembly, it would be in a subject person. So the sovereign could take it to himself at his pleasure, which means that the right belonged to him all along. And if this right belonged to no particular man, and was left to a new choice after the death of the present sovereign, then the Commonwealth would be dissolved, and the right to decide the succession would belong to whoever could get it, which is contrary to the intention of those who instituted the Commonwealth in the first place, which they did for their perpetual, and not just their temporary, security. In a democracy, the whole assembly can't die unless the multitude that are to be governed die. So in that form of government, questions about the right of deciding the succession don't arise. In an aristocracy, when any member of the assembly dies, the choice of someone else to take his place is for the assembly to make, because it's the sovereign to whom belongs the right of choosing of all councillors and officers. For what the representative does as actor is done by every one of the subjects as author. The sovereign assembly may give powers to others to choose new members to make up their numbers, but it's still by their authority that the choice is made, and by their authority that the choice may be cancelled if the public good requires it. The greatest difficulty about the right of succession occurs in monarchy. The difficulty arises from the fact that it isn't immediately obvious who is to appoint the successor to a king who has died, and in cases where it was clearly the role of the king to do this, it is often not obvious whom he has appointed. For both these cases require thinking that is more precise than men in general are accustomed to. As to the question of who shall appoint the successor of a monarch, the central point is this. Either he who now possesses the sovereign power has the right to decide the succession, or else that right reverts to the dissolved multitude, which is thereby threatened with sliding into war. I am saying this about a monarch who possesses sovereign authority, so that the right of succession is the right of inheritance, not about elective kings and princes, who don't own the sovereign power, but merely have the use of it. For the death of him who possesses the sovereign power leaves the multitude without any sovereign at all, that is, without any representative in whom they can be united, and be capable of acting. So they can't act in any way at all, which implies that they can't elect any new monarch. In this state of affairs, every man has an equal right to submit himself to whomever he thinks best able to protect him, or, if he can, to protect himself by his own sword, which is a return to confusion and to the condition of a war of every man against every man. This makes it obvious that the institution of monarchy always leaves the choice of the successor to the judgment and will of the present possessor of sovereignty. Sometimes a question arises about who has been designated by the monarch to the succession and inheritance of his power. It is to be answered on the basis of his explicit words and testament, or by other sufficient wordless signs. By explicit words or testament, when it is declared by him in his lifetime, orally or in writing, as the first emperors of Rome declared who were their heirs. So if a monarch explicitly declares that such and such a man is to be his heir, doing this either orally or in writing, then that man acquires the right of being monarch immediately after the death of his predecessor. But in the absence of testament and explicit words, other natural signs of the sovereign's wishes should be followed. One of these is custom, where it is customary for the monarch to be succeeded by his next of kin. With no conditions on that, the next of kin does have the right to the succession. For if the previous monarch had wanted something different, he could easily have said so in his lifetime. Likewise, where the custom is that the succession goes to the male who is next of the kin, the right of succession in that case does go to the male next of kin, for the same reason. Similarly, if the custom were to advance the female next of kin. For if a man could by a word modify an existing custom, yet doesn't do so, that is a natural sign that he wants the custom to stand unchanged. What if neither custom nor the monarch's testament has been provided? Then it should be understood first that the monarch wanted the government to remain monarchical, because he approved that government in himself. Secondly, that he wanted a child of his own, male or female, to be preferred before any other, because men are presumed to be naturally more inclined to advance their own children than those of other men, and of their own a male rather than a female, because men are naturally fitter than women for actions of labour and danger. Thirdly, if he has no descendants, that he wanted to be succeeded by a brother rather than a stranger, and, generalising from that, to have a successor close to him in blood rather than one more remote, because it's always presumed that closeness of kinship goes with closeness of affection, and it's evident that the greatness of a man's nearest kindred reflects the most honour on him. But if it is lawful for a monarch to settle the succession on someone by words of contract or testament, men may perhaps object that there is a great disadvantage in this, for he may sell or give his right of governing to a foreigner, and this may lead to the oppression of his subjects, because people who are foreigners to one another, that is, men who don't customarily live under the same government or speak the same language, commonly undervalue one another. This is indeed a great disadvantage, but if there's oppression in such a case, it may come not from the mere fact that the government is foreign, but rather from the unskilfulness of the governors, their ignorance of the true rules of politics. That is why the Romans, when they had subdued many nations, and wanted to make their government digestible to them, usually removed that grievance of oppression entirely by foreigners, as much as they thought it necessary to do so, by giving sometimes to whole nations, and sometimes to principal men of conquered nations, not only the privileges of Romans, but also the title Roman, and admitted many of them to the Senate, and to official positions, even in the Roman city. That is what our most wise King James aimed at in trying to unite his two realms of England and Scotland. Had he succeeded in this, it would probably have prevented the civil wars that make both those kingdoms miserable now. So it's not an offence against the people for a monarch to make a foreigner his successor, though disadvantages sometimes come from that, through the fault either of the rulers or of their citizens. End of chapter 19.